all the sacrifices.
I know you have all kinds of other business that's clashing with the economy. We have been holding off this activity for some time, sensitive amongst other things to the fact that soon after the elections, the constitution of the fourth parliament, there's been a whole lot of rush to finish other urgent business of parliament, and colleagues would have been preoccupied with the budget process, with other committee work and so on. But at some point, certain things would have to be done. So we are at a point where we can't hold things off for much further. And we have to get certain things going. I thought, by way of introduction, I must just give a general overview of what this committee is about, the kind of work we do, and our modus operandi and so on. It's a subcommittee of the Rules Committee. It advises the only surviving subcommittee of the Rules Committee. Previously, the Rules Committee had a whole host of other subcommittees which were abolished when they formed the POA, which deals with the management of parliament. And the way we've operated in the past is that we would only consider rule amendments by instruction of the Rules Committee of Joint Rules. And usually we wouldn't deal with political or policy issues that have not yet been processed out. So we'd be coming at the tail end where technical adjustments to the rules have to be made to give effect to those policy changes. I think the approach in the last Rules meeting has sort of given us far more responsibility than that, in the sense that unfrozen policy or political matters are now before us by virtue of having been referred in whole to us to deal with. And the nature and size of our committee also seems to have changed. We used to be a much smaller committee. Now we are a fully fledged committee, the size of a portfolio committee. So don't be deceived by the thinness of the presence here. We have how many? 14 members?
Yes.
Yeah. We were still waiting for Mr. What's his name? To come up with a name for the smaller party.
Dr. Mulder, so we still short one man for the smaller parties. He's the one member that we need, and yeah, one more man from the smaller parties.
The other thing that kept delaying to really get the smaller parties represented, because from time to time, issues affecting them specifically do arise, and it would be good for them to have a presence. Just to say that we have in the last Parliament been instructed and have done so to establish a number of new institutions in the room, which I'm not going to. Once again, there's more new institutions that have been established, and we are being called to write rules to establish them. One of the trickiest ones, which we're going to get a full presentation on today, arises out of the course of many years. Parliament never got around to passing a law that enables it to amend money bills. Now, that finally happened. We now have the Money Bills Amendment Act of 2009. Now, that act prompts Parliament to make adjustments to its rules, to respond to a whole number of procedural and constitutional arrangements that arise out of that. So we're going to have a presentation on that this year. What is it that has implications for there is also the broader project of that we have done since the last time of reviewing the whole rulebook. Because we find stuff in the rulebook which is obsolete, you know, at some point. In fact, in the last rules meeting, for example, we had to agree to abolish things that were in the rules, like the RDP committee, which had since ceased to exist years ago, but it was still in the rules. The chairperson of the Constitutional Review Committee was saying to me the other day, but the rules say this is how we're supposed to be constituted. And I said, no, a whole lot of rules are simply suppressed by resolution of the House. So what you see in the rule book is not really what pertains. And the idea is to really make the rule book reflective of reality, and not say one thing when practice does something completely different. But also we have had the rules being developed by way of conventions or decisions or what you call them, standing orders or something.
We don't really call them that, but they're the equivalent to sessional orders that we have, things that are valid for a particular session. So, for example, if you have a certain sequence of, for example, member statements, the sequence of member statements, that's decided afresh every time.
So we have all those kind of things which you'll never find in the rule book. So part of what we would be striving towards is to make the rule book, especially for a new member, to really reflect what actually happened, so that people know where to find the law. How does one find all these other things? I mean, if you want to know, for example, the rule that says you cannot reflect on a member, on a fellow member.
That's contained in the rule.
Is it in the
rule? In the rule.
All right. I thought the rule was contained.
Yeah, but it isn't treatment of the house.
Oh, all right. But I'm just saying the stuff that is not necessarily as shown as reflecting it, and one has to basically look at that. There's a document, and that's the other thing that's before you. There's this document here, which was done in 2003 by the Chief Whip's Forum. Which sought to reflect on some of the practices in the House, these have been the rules. It's titled Decorum in the House, but it goes beyond issues of decorum. It really talks about procedural issues and other things. So that would be one of the things that should inform the process of reviewing the rules. But we'd also need to look at other parliaments, what practices are out there, what are the hidden happening things in the conduct of business of parliaments, so that we update our own rules and bring them in line with other parliaments.
And I just mentioned that once I started to I've brought in one of the new documents that I put out there was one which goes together with this document, comparative research that was done with three African parliaments, just in regard to the quorum issue. So those two documents go together.
All right. I think that would be interesting to look at. Now, I talked about institutional arrangements. One of the new committees that was decided by the previous parliament and which has now been referred by the Rules Committee for us to look at is the establishment of a joint committee on HIV. But that's for the joint component of the review. Remember, we are sitting now at the NA component. We will schedule a meeting as soon as the NCLP is ready. That will be joined between us and them to look at joint business. Now, that's one of the issues that's going to be coming up there. But for now, I think let's stick to the agenda before us. That was just my general overview of where we are at. The first item relates to the matter I was talking to, and that is the review of rules. Yes, in fact, that's why I should have crossed it. Are there any further apologies?
Yes, we have from Mr. Ben Martins and Ms. Cohen, Mr. Vete and Dr. Mulder. And then Mr. Ambrosini has apologized and said he'll be late because he has to get a situation for Saudi Arabia meeting.
JJ also mentioned the problem of the clash between justice and I really appreciate the Comrade Ireland for making the sacrifice.
It's been quite a moment.
One of the proposals that is being put forward is that this project of reviewing the rules is an extensive piece of work, and that we should request the rules committee to appoint the consultant for that work. The table staff is proposing this. Mr. Hendrick, who has been the secretary of the assembly in time immemorial and had all the institutional memory, now retired, would be an ideal candidate for assisting us. I don't know how it works. Do you go out for tender, or is there any rules relating to procurement arising out of this?
No, what we are doing is motivating to the speaker that if a committee decides that they want to use Mr. Hendrick, what we are saying is that because it's such a specialist issue, there aren't other people. We are motivated to the speaker and saying to the speaker, only Mr. Hendrick knows how to do this job, and maybe Advocate Anton Mayer was also mentioned, but I mean, the expert in this particular field is he himself, between Mr. Hendrick by far.
I think the argument really is that it doesn't matter how much you know the law or you know parliamentary procedure, if you do not carry the institutional memory arising out of this parliament, it can be quite challenging to come clean into it, you know?
He was also there when the first set of rules were done in 94. He was agreed to do that whole process. And he was also there in 99 for the second comprehensive review of the rules. So he's aware of where he, and he also adopted the NCRT rule.
All right.
So he knows what
the effect is. From our side also, we don't have other options, so we're very happy with him.
Look, we don't make any decisions, do we? I mean, we just recommend.
No,
to just recommend. Committee.
We're not asking the speaker.
Do we need a quorum about this?
I don't think so, because the decision doesn't lie with us. We are making a request to the speaker to appoint this person. We're requesting.
Look, JJ has an issue about it. She's asking the question, can't you guys do it yourself?
No, we don't.
So can you stick to that? Can you convince
Unfortunately, yes, I can. We're only about three at the MA table. The rest of our staff are fairly young and inexperienced and quite new to the table business. I mean, the three people who are there who can actually... I mean, I wouldn't even include myself as being capable of doing something as comprehensive as this. And I've been in Parliament for 21 years. And I mean, I think I know a bit more than most. But we really don't have the capacity. I mean, because we're running on empty as it is. Just keeping the house going and keeping, you know, with picking up all the
blood from could this be? Wouldn't we be repeating some of the stuff anyway? And maybe there will just be areas where I'm just being the devil's advocate.
Well, I would say what I understood from the...
I also chair the Committee on the Auditor General, so the idea of of letting our sense go the long way.
So one can understand that, I mean, the idea is for Tanya and me, we'll be assisting with the Handi. We'll be doing the actual drafting, but under his supervision of the rules. So we will be using the parliamentary staff to the extent, as far as we can, but we really need, you need that eye from outside to look at things, and he's got such a broad perspective of the rules, you know, sort of that I wouldn't feel myself even capable, and I'm sure Kamal would feel the same as Mansoura and Masibu. We can do it, but I should guarantee that it wouldn't be the same product at a school with Mr. Handik. It's just too big a job.
I've been involved in a couple of these rules to exercise over the years. It's always been done by somebody close to Parliament or from the outside. It's a major exercise. It's much bigger than we think. Writing up all these rules. If you change one rule, the whole sequence changes. It's a cumulative thing all the time.
I asked Marina to, in the meantime, prepare draft terms of reference in the event that the subcommittee finds favour with the suggestion, so that the...
It's a document called draft memorandum. It's in the form of a memorandum to the speaker from Mr. Masuta. That's the format. It's a draft document. It looks like this. It's one of the documents that we had. Did we pick it up from there?
Let's just make sure everybody has a copy. I know I did it at the last minute because she thought that we didn't agree on the proposal. Let me also just mention, you know, my approach to this meeting is that I always convene a meeting once with a document to look at, not to discuss about a document that's going to be generated. That's my general policy. So before we even decide on the need to draft rules, immediately after a whole committee meeting, I instruct the table staff to formulate drafts so that when we sit, we actually looking at something. So it is in that spirit that I said to her, make sure that this morning we have something to look at. Do you want to just quickly take us through this?
Okay, I've done it in the form of a memorandum to the speaker. So once the speaker approves, then we would have to go through the whole thing about drafting a contract and doing a, you know, seeing what the term of the contract will be and things like that. But what we're basically saying is that the background is the fact that the Joint Rules Committee and the House Committee have agreed to a comprehensive review of all sets of rules. A deadline hasn't been set for this particular task to be completed. So on the second page, I've done a thing called duration of the project. I'm proposing that we give ourselves until June next year for this comprehensive review to be completed. But it would be for Mr. Handik, should he come, to determine the process. In other words, this is what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, 1, 2, 3, and it will take so long to do this and so long to do this. In other words, for him to set up the time frame of how we envisage things happening. Obviously, it will be influenced by the meetings of the committee, because that will also happen on a regular basis, etc.
So we basically would be inviting him to present a proposal that says, this is how I propose it going to be.
Yes.
And at this, only that point, I would assume that we can then safely enter into a formal contract.
Yes.
So the proposal would be his response to the offer by way of acceptance, and that would then be the point of the meeting of the mind, at which point we can then safely say the parameters of the contract have been agreed from the past.
I think he accepts the contract or not. I mean, we are saying that there's no one else to do the job, so and he's already indicated that he would be willing to do it. I've spoken to him informally, and he's indicated that he's available. So, So the next step is that, okay, then you do the contract, and then I envisage the first meeting with the subcommittee of Mr. Hanik to be for him to give us a background on the origin of rules and what we're going, and then to give us to outline a process and time frame.
Is it at that point the certainty as to what the mutual rights and obligations are? And at that point, can we say to say we have a clear contractual relationship? And then that becomes the binding. Because you see, what you don't want is, I have experienced it with doing alterations to my old house, where the builder comes and says, but these are extra, it's not part of the original contract, and you end up paying double what you originally were hoping to pay for. Alright, so that is the idea. You want to take
Okay, the terms of reference I said the review process will commence with a briefing and a presentation by Mr. Hanik on the origin and development of the current semi-rule, followed by a discussion on the subcommittee on the scope and extent of the review. Then, informed by the above discussion and in consultation with the subcommittee, Mr. Hanik will then outline the process, as I've just mentioned. I've said the process identified should include, initially, a procedural scan to determine what obtains in respect of the current rules. In other words, the already proposed changes in the current rules, notes on where there have been suggestions previously that certain things should be done and indicated, for him to bring in that particular thing. Then there are proposals contained in this decorum document that the Chief Whip did. There are rule changes proposed by the DA, for example. I think one of the proposals is that this goes into the mix as part of the review process. The proposed rule changes, and there are also individual MPs who, Mr. Ambrosini, who will be here later, he's proposing certain rule changes and things like that. So that all that goes into the mix of the review of rules, and so the process will start with by putting all those things together and starting to, you know, get the whole thing together. The main part of the review process will consist of a detailed and meticulous discussion of the various proposed rule changes and or adjustments. A small technical task team could perhaps be identified for this purpose. This is just, I think, just for working purposes from the subcommittee, two or three people to work closely, so that we don't need as much detailed discussion when we come to the actual subcommittee meeting. I said Mr. Hanik will be assisted by designated staff of the NA table and other parliamentary staff as and when required. It should be noted that the drafting of the rules will be done by the subcommittee supporting staff, supervised by Mr. Hanik. Should any comparative research be required, that will also be done by the staff supporting the committee, obviously under your supervision. And then I've just included the motivation to the speaker to say that the nature of the work to be undertaken is such that it would not really serve any purpose to call on another person to tender for the work. The work is of a specialist procedural nature that requires specific skills. And then the subcommittee is of the view that Mr. Hanik's many years of procedural and parliamentary experience will serve as a good sounding board for the review envisaged by the Rules Committee. And then I'm ended by saying the rules are the cornerstone of the manner in which business is conducted in Parliament and determine how the Houses function. It is therefore of the utmost importance that the end result of the review process, in other words, a new set of rules for both Houses and for the joint business of Parliament, should be of the highest quality and be able to withstand the severest scrutiny of tests. Mr. Hanik's considerable hands-on experience, his practical approach to matters, and his remarkable ability to focus matters on the essence of what is required are qualities which are essential in the review process.
Is it necessary for us in this document to mention some of the envisaged major reforms, institutional reforms, that would invariably impact on this process, such as the matter of, that we're going to be briefed on today, of the newly acquired authority of amending money bills and all the complex procedures in the position there.
I think those are
of the oversight model and its implications for changes to the rules, the whole decorum document and the kind of different things that it says need to be re-looked at as examples of some of the things that trust. So somebody who's looking at it says, what exactly really are we?
But I'm thinking, my idea is if one could include it. So what I'm saying is that those things were the reason, or some of the motivating reasons for the rule review, is the fact that we've had so many new, like the powers and privileges and the oversight models, all those things, and all those things will inform the review process anyway. That gave rise to the fact that we need to review the rules. So I don't know whether one should use it as a motivation of how we're going to.
And I'm just saying this for the record. Somebody who's not been here in the last parliament and doesn't know what happened prior to this decision in 2007 might ask the question, but what? Why? Why suddenly we want to review the rules? What's so critical that needs to happen? And what is the extent of the work that necessitates such a major project? You know, that kind of thing.
No, I agree with you, Chair. We face with a problem with a situation where the bulk of the members now are not returning members, they are new members.
Mm-hmm.
And you're quite right, Chair, that question is you function quite well since 1994. So where does this need now to do the rules arise? I think that's an important point for me to look at.
Actually, the Deputy Speaker of Colding asked you the question, why do you want something to be done with you?
There you go. But Chair, can I also raise two issues? One, without having discussed this with JJ, I'm assuming that JJ is concerned about costs. Let me say at the outset that I agree with everyone that there is no other person other than this. But having said that, I think we must also agree that that doesn't mean that Mr. Kastanambi can write his own check. In other words, if he comes here and he says to us, well, you need to give me another 5 years, do we say, okay, go ahead? Or were we really allowed to consider that aspect? Because essentially, he says, I'll need at least 5 years. That's a long time. There are financial implications. And I think that's what JJ is probably alluding to when he said, well, can't the internal staff do it? So we would need some kind of indication of how long it takes. This is an extended period of time. It involves financial implications that we need to think about. And then we need to have an indication, clear indication, at which point does this subcommittee or the NA Rules Committee look at the proposed changes in order to apply their minds and then vote aye or nay. That has to happen as well.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that if Mr. Ambrosini tables, because a lot of us make this mistake, we assume that because something has been referred to this review subcommittee and it is then handed over to Mr. Handik, that it's going to end up in this green book. That doesn't necessarily mean so. And some people may well go to the media and say, I've given them all my stuff, you're going to find it in the green book. At some point, someone has to say, this is a proposed amendment for a new rule. Do you accept it or do you reject it? You know, that aspect needs to also be clarified.
Look, no rule changes go through to the House, let alone to the review of rules, to the Rules Committee, except via this committee, unless it's a fairly straightforward thing where the Rules Committee has made a decision and have not found a need to refer to the review of rules, and therefore they can go straight to the House, which is also an option for the Rules Committee. But anything that's been referred to us, and where an expert has been appointed to assist us, he is an advisor to us, not even to the Rules Committee. And therefore they're directly accountable to us in terms of what they produce, we need to present it to us, we need to look at it, we need to be satisfied with that is the kind of thing that is in a state that can be presented for the host community, let alone for the house. So I see that expert, hence the proposal, puts a lot of emphasis on the relationship between the expert and the subcommittee, not even with the host community. The issue of time frame, Marina proposes mid next year. I'm not sure how realistic it is. We have it finished by now.
Yes, but it's Marina. Is Mr. Handick okay with that? I'm not going to come and say, no, that's Andre.
No, for now, let's understand it this way. This subgroup is putting an offer, if you like, in the form of a proposed terms of reference, which goes to the speaker and then goes to Mr. Handick. Mr. Handick must then react by way of accepting the offer. He accepts it on the basis of those changes on the terms of reference that he thought are necessary for the whole arrangement to suit him as well and to be realistic from the point. So it is only once, that's why I kept on saying to Marina that until there is the meeting of the mind between the offerer and the offeree in terms of this contractual arrangement, we don't have a contract. So once Mr. Handick has said, no, I suggest that we arrange it and operate this way, we look at what he and if we are happy with his reaction, his response, then there is a meeting of the mind. And only at that point do we then formally draft a contract. You know, and then the contract will simply reflect.
I agree that it is an understatement. And I just say that it's also a responsibility and understanding because Mr. Handick will not compile the proof in the rules and brief us or present as one document in hand. It is a continuous process.
Mm-hmm.
He will do a section of the rules, and then he needs the committee.
Yeah, but I also don't see a process, Chair, whereby it's open-ended.
There
has to be a cut-off point. Marina's quite right. She's looking at June next year.
Yeah.
Fine. But that's the whole process.
Mm.
That's true.
I've included, I said the parties to the agreement may vary or adjust the duration of the project, provided it is reduced to writing and signed by or on behalf of all parties. So in other words, if there's any change, you put such an initial type of statement, if there's any change to that, if any of the parties feel that they need more time, it can be done, but then it must be written and agreed and it must be formal.
Remember, this is the terms of reference for purposes of putting forward our proposal. Ultimately, there will have to be a formal contract between Parliament and the consultant, and a certain standard contractual clauses that would obviously go into it. The legal section of the committee or the procurement section will have to do all of that. But for our purposes, we need to be clear as to how we sort of visualize this project actually happening. And that's why we're having this discussion. For example, a model that you've proposed is one where he does chunks, comes back to us, bounce ideas with us, so it's an interactive process, as opposed to him going away, sitting somewhere on the beach on the Bahamas, writing it all up, and then coming back 6 months or 8 months down the line, throwing it all at us. And then we say, no, but half of this stuff is off the mark in terms of what it is we envisage. So we need to have a much more interactive kind of process where he'll do some. I would imagine the first step in any case would be for him to do a discussion paper of some kind. So that we get a sense of, you know, crystallized issues that need to be dealt with, what are the experiences elsewhere, what problems, problematic with our rules, etc., whatever comes out. before it goes to the actual formulation of the stuff. So that we agree on the parameters and the principles on what's been identified as stuff that needs to be corrected, and if so, in what way, in which direction. So I think that's more or less how we would sort of want to approach it. But I suppose time has become a factor. Last year, we did battle with, for example, writing rules for the operationalization of the Powers and Privileges Act. One of the issues we never got to resolve, which is still before the party, is whether we should regulate free speech in the House, and if so, to what extent. Llewellyn sent us in the House and says all kinds of nasty things about a member of the public who's not a member of the House, who's not a judge or any of the people in the system. Under the Powers and Privileges Act, all you can do is that if that member makes a request in terms of the Act to have his view or her view been published in the 80s, then that's the only recourse they have. But we haven't quite come up with a form of censure to a member who just goes out to the case in point is the DeLille case, where the court, constitutional court, said unless you have a rule that limits that, that regulates that, you know, you can't really do any sanction against the member, you know, take any action against them. So that's where matters were left. Now, the decorum document I see touches on this, but it doesn't itself offer a solution. We've had a previous discussion document on that, but it was simply explaining the legal situation without saying to what extent can be. So there are those little things. So you'd have to go and look at other parliaments to see if they are supposed to ask to learn. That's just by way of example of some of the things that are kind of still outstanding that need to be further sorted in the new process. All right, so that is the document. subject to whatever few suggestions that have been made, I suppose we are in agreement with the proposal.
Yes.
All right. The final text will then be circulated to members, and if we within 2 days and get any particular reaction, we'll then sign it.
Can I just ask that I'll circulate it to members and at least to me, and see the document for them to notice as a speaker, this is not for public consumption. Just that members, and this is a memo to the speaker from Mr. Masuta, actually. This is basically for using to drop this weekend, but just keep this confidential.
All right.
We can give them back to
you. Okay, that's fine. Whatever. But I'm going to be sending you a revised version, so I'll mail that to you. But if members can just see that it doesn't sort of land up on the front page of the August Mr. Hundick.
All right, so that exhausts item A and B under 3, which takes us to C, and that is the DA proposal. Is there anybody?
That's just a proposal for the DA rules, which they've already submitted. They tabled that at the NA rules, and that's just that one.
Yeah.
Federal form
part of
the
standard.
Okay, so right. Everybody's agreed that if that happens, it's fine.
All right. Okay, if that be so, then...
Did you want it to appear come before us yet?
Well, the Rules Committee has referred it to us, and I suppose we could in turn refer it to... But I don't know if the committee wants to take preliminary discussion or presentation or how you want to do it. you want to just automatically send it off.
My view would be that it should be part of the matrix. The Gandhi will probably get many more submissions from individuals or committee members. Which we will consider and we will have to shoot it down eventually if it's necessary.
Yeah. Look, if the DA is happy with it, with that approach, that's fine. Because I wouldn't want...
Can I just tell the woman? Yeah, here the jury is the same. On the surface, it's fine. And notwithstanding the time frame that we've agreed on, what are you going to do then if we suddenly get a flood? Where this entire book then is going to be rewritten. So we just need to be mindful of that and actually give people a deadline whereby after a certain date, that's it, you can't come forward with any more. Otherwise, Mr. Andy
in
a single person joint standing committee on...
In fact, you're raising an important issue. And that is the issue that says, if this project goes ahead and it's approved, we need to, as a subcommittee, formally request the Rules Committee to agree to a time frame within which parties would be invited to make submissions to this process regarding the change, so that the process is inclusive, because you don't want us here sitting as wise men and wise women deciding for the entire institution what needs to be reviewed without anybody else's input. Alright? So let's propose that there be some period within which be it parties or parties and individual members are invited to put forward any issue that they would want to go into the review. And obviously, as this committee will ultimately be stepping through all of that.
I don't understand. I would say, that the party do this, they bring the proposal as a party, or to make it through the rest. I would say,
No, we're just saying this is a new and a major overhaul of the book.
For the whole book?
Yeah, of the whole book.
Okay.
And because of this being such a major project, it would be good for it to be as inclusive as possible. So that after this work is completed, nobody comes to work and says, yeah, it was just a handful of people sitting there and deciding what needs to be done. That's why we said earlier to Marina that it is important for us to also mention some of the things that prompted this decision from our side, which relates mainly to specific projects such as the oversight model that's been proposed, the reform of the budget process in Parliament, where Parliament the current document where the chief report looked at the rules and came with specific issues that said needed to be reviewed or looked at. So we need to mention those which are initiated by the institution. But to say that over and above those things, we think this is an opportune time to also allow the broader membership, either as individual or through their political party, to reflect on the rules and to give input as to what they think from their point of view also needs to be reviewed. So that those things are looked at now when the rules are being reviewed. So that later people don't say, yeah, but you know, this review process didn't look at issues like this thing that members must be uncovered when they go into the house, but what about Muslim people who have particular religious practices and so on and so on. So all those issues, everybody can say we never had an opportunity to suggest that needs to be revisited. You know? So that is the suggestion. I don't know if you...
No, I think sometimes we don't go from those concerns as to how then do other practices make their contributions, and I think we
So we will make that proposal to the Rules Committee and say such an invitation must be an informal, I mean a formal invitation, but it must be time-bound so that by the time it's done, it's done to do the work, people have the opportunity. Now, I don't know at what point would we say that all of this has come together and now Mr. Handick can start. Because if we envisage a situation where within the next week or two already he could start work, we are unrealistic in terms of the preliminary processes that need to occur. Contracts are still need to be drafted. This process that I've just mentioned, where staff might still be coming in and so on. Can I also just, in this regard, also mention that some of the policy reforms are still in progress. I suppose the oversight model is complete. Where is it now?
So also there's explicit implementation committee, they're looking at things. They're going to make certain recommendations.
They might make some.
Yeah, and we need to look at, there's certain things that we need to look at, but I mean, they've all started, they've not started with the implementation, and eventually we'll be told we need to do this in regard to the rules.
So in a sense, what I'm saying is that some of the policy reforms are still in the cooking. And obviously, only once there's certainty as to what the final position is, would they then find expression in the group. So we must just make sure that we don't have a situation where Mr. Handick is having to work with documents that have not yet been formalized as the new policy, and then have a time problem. Where he's got to finish his work, but he's got to work with stuff that's not yet ready to be worked with. So that kind of clarity of coordination is important. We're just going to look out for that. The issue of the money bill, for example, I understand that some of the stuff in that act may need to be relooked because of the practical implications. So if that happens, you know, whatever arrangement that you are planning to do in the rules may change. So we need to look at keep a focused eye on those developments as well. But I think we'll leave the that for now.
Just to go back to Barbara's question, I'm sorry to
understand.
No, can we accept then that we're going to ask all the political parties that are in Parliament to make their submissions if they want to. But if a Mr. Ambrosini on his own as a member of Parliament also wishes to make a proposed rule change, then that will also be considered. That's her question.
That is the question I'm asking the Commission. Should we confine it to parties? Look, the advantage of confining it to parties would make sure that a party processes things within itself, and that it's able. Because you see, if you invite members, then a member says one thing and his party says another, and you may end up pitching that members within your own party, pitching people into a problem. I think we should propose.
Are we going to limit members or not? In all committees.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question.
Because members are allowed to bring things before all committees. Why would you want to limit them in this
committee? If a member chooses to bypass his or her party, then he's then embarrassed when it comes here and it's shut down because that party then says, we know nothing about it, they're voting against him, and he or she is sitting there, well, it's not cookie. I don't know, but, you know, I mean, as ANC, we know, I can't just come here and say to you, Mike, please protest. You know, we go through the organization. But
in
right now, Mr. Ambrosini says, well, you know, I'm a respected lawyer, I'm going to make the submission.
In fact, the way parties would normally do this is that they would have study groups that mirroring the correct English word, the actual committee work, so that they process politically within the party and generate the party position for the party, the technical work. So the party has processed that ahead of submitting a party position. But that's internal party business and how the party conducts its own affairs. So
in one respect, we're very lucky. There are very few members who are interested in the room.
Yeah.
We won't be signed under, I'm sure.
Look, I mean, obviously, the room committee would need to decide because we can't simply start inviting people tomorrow. We have to present this before the room committee as to what we're proposing should happen. I mean, I know Marina saying we're writing to the speaker. I don't know if the speaker will then decide and then the whole thing starts running without reference to the room committee. I would be loath because people could then shoot it down once it's constructed with its rules. It's one thing for the rules to have approved that there is a review of rules. It's quite another for a project on review of rules with a consultant appointed in a project time, if you like, thing, where you have an actual project with a budget, with a consultant, with the whole process. I would be more comfortable if we got the blessings of the rules itself.
Obviously, we one of the, well, it refers back to the terms of reference. Now, one of the terms of reference is that Mr. Hundy comes forward with a kind of a project plan, if you call it that, timeline of when what will happen. Could one not, as a preliminary, or as part of, as our report to the rules committee, present them with that project plan and say this is how we envisage this will happen and get their blessing on that.
I'm just saying we should table stuff before the rules want to try. I would be loath to this notion of talks about talks only happened in Codes. But after Codes, we don't talk about talks. So I would prefer a situation where at the very final stage of the process where we are just about to sign a contract with Mr. Hundy, table the thing in its almost final form to the Rules Committee and say this is what is proposed. Right? Speaker's been involved all the way, so on. And then let the Rules give a final stamp of approval, then we know no political party will come and embarrass us afterwards and say, yeah, you're coming with this consulting thing and so on. Can't even embarrass the speaker who would have approved without the rules committee without having felt that they've been thoroughly engaged in. So I would certainly support that idea. For now, the philosophy. I'm just not confident that Mr. Hendrick would be finished or the project would be completed by the deadline. I'm thinking, given the fact that there's this preliminary stages that are still going to happen before Mr. Hendrick starts to put pen to paper and start writing his first sentence on the book. But, all right.
let's see how it goes. Obviously, time frames can be reviewed once the final agreement is reached. And that is what we can mention at that point. So that's a working thing for now, I think. Maybe we can get it. All right. So that's how we have dealt with item C as well. Item D, delicious. What's the story there?
Remember, we were going to look at a couple of rule changes already in the book, and we said it's not practical. So that's all the way.
All right. In the last rules committee, there's a number of obsolete stuff that we cleaned up, right? Like I said, things like RGB commission and so on. But there's still a lot of stuff that's still there. Now, one approach was to say, in the meantime, while the major review process is still being underway, some of these things could be picked up and incrementally corrected as we go along. Not necessarily forming part of the project. So in other words, rule improvement should not come to a complete halt pending the major review on things that can readily be sorted out. Another view, of course, is that let's defer everything for this major project to be sorted out. Some of the things may look fairly straightforward, but then it gets tricky. For example, the rules still refer to the leader of the house. Now, there's no such thing as a leader of the house. There is a leader of government business. I don't know where the leader of the house came from.
Mr. Pretorius can explain
it. The stalwarts of the institution can tell us how it all came from. But an issue may be it was a good institution. Why not resuscitate it? Arguments to be put back to that effect. You know, there's been changes to the system along the way, and somewhere along the way, some people say, but hang on, why don't we go back to the old system? The DA is calling for interpolation, for example. I mean, we had interpolation and we did away with them. But the DA felt that we should actually bring them. In fact, we never agreed with their abolition in the first place, if my institutional memory serves me well. But I'm just saying, you may think it's a fairly straightforward. There was the issue about the rule saying leader of the official opposition, when in fact the constitution talked of the leader of the opposition being the leader of the largest minority party in parliament. The DA was saying we'll be happy with the rule being adjusted to bring them in line with the constitution, if I remember well. But the smaller parties were saying, why have such a thing called the leader of the opposition? Because they don't necessarily lead us, we are autonomous. But the constitution said what it said. So this subcom and the rules committee had no choice but to comply with the constitution. So I'm just saying, whenever you reopen some of these issues, other new dynamics usually come into the play sometimes. And then you can't ignore them. You have to give people a platform and then decide finally on a way forward. So what do we do? Marina, you were suggesting something by deleting this.
What we had initially thought to do was to go through the rule book and where there are already sort of indications that things could possibly be changed, you know, the obvious kind of things.
Okay.
Because there are some of the rules, you know, have notes attached to them on certain things. For example, we look at the leader of the house issue and leader of government business. But the fact is that not necessarily in every single rule where there's a reference to leader of the house does it correlate with the role that the leader of government business has. So that's also something that needs to be discussed. So we thought rather keep hands off and include those rules as part of the rule review. In other words, when they look at those things, because there are obviously issues that need discussion between parties. And in some cases, discussion between the two houses, you know, on certain issues when it comes to the joint business.
If I mention, yeah. I think when it comes to things like the leader of the house, I think the obvious thing to do is to look at it and look at its context. In some cases, it might need a simple change from leader of the house to leader of government. But in others, you may just need to scrap the rule. It just depends on which one.
Well, the bottom line is that there isn't such an animal anyway.
No.
The leader of the house.
Yes.
So, whatever. Tell me, leader of the house, is something of a product of the rules, or is it some that come from the constitution itself?
No, it came from Britain.
Originally, it was the most senior cabinet minister in the House of Commons. It was appointed by the Prime Minister to look after these affairs once he was away. The goal of the position that we have today, the person who represents government in the House.
So that's what it's similar to the leader of the government as well.
Yeah.
Or is it called leader of the house?
Leader of the house.
What a nice title. I like
so
it.
That's an interesting thing. That we call it leader of government business, they call it leader of the house.
I prefer leader of government business.
It's much more.
Leader of the house,
it's just the wrong conversation.
Yeah, it leads to a whole lot of other things that you want to stay away from.
Yeah. I think. Do we want to continue with identifying some such things? Let me say that process will not be new. Because like I said at the last rule, there's a number of things that we already put forward. You know? And even in the last parliament, I alluded to the leader of the opposition as official. But there's also other problems. The joint defense. Let me start this way. At the last rules committee, a proposal was accepted to the effect that to give equal status between the two houses, we should no longer have something called a deputy chair when there's a joint committee. There should be a chair and a co-chair. Now, the deputy chair was an unsalaried position. And the effect of elevating that position to that of a chair would have had financial implications. But the main argument was that it would have given effect to the constitution in the sense of equating, you know, giving equal status to both companies, to a joint committee. Now that was decided, it was agreed, and specialized changes had to be effected to make sure that that happened. But when it came to the joint defense committee, a can of worms started opening up. Now, I know Mr. Dan Muntisi is the NCOP co-chair of joint defense. Now, apparently the rules do not refer to a deputy when it comes to joint defense, let alone a co-chair. And the resolution of the rules committee was to convert any reference to deputy co-chair. Now, if there is no reference at all, there's nothing to convert. But in practice, there is a position and a person who is filling that position. So you have that kind of anomaly. It hasn't been formally referred to us, but it arises out of a decision of the rules last time that resulted in amendments. I suppose it's a matter that can be referred back to the next joint committee, all right, by the relevant people who compile the agenda of the joint committee to be dealt with.
because it's not just a technical thing of making amendments to the rule. It's a policy issue. Those that know the history of the Joint Defense Committee would be in a better position to explain to us, because apparently the way it's constituted is used a formula that's completely different from constituting any other joint committee. Llewellyn, you have some experience of that.
Yeah, Chair, I've just quickly gone through the rules. It may be a creature of the joint rule, and goes to
the joint incident.
Marina has the joint rule. Can
so,
you tell us a bit about what it is?
There are only three rules that pertain to Joint Standing Committee on Defence. So one is status of it. It says there is a Joint Standing Committee on Defence as required by Section 283 of the Constitution of 93. It's still in the provision of the interim constitution. Then it talks about the membership. Now, the membership of the Joint Standing Committee on Defence is determined according to a certain formula where you take the total number of members of Parliament, because it's a Joint Committee, so it would be 454. Yeah. And all parties... you take that total membership, it is equal to the number obtained by dividing by 10 the total number of seats held in the National Assembly by all parties holding more than 10 seats. Sorry, not you don't take you don't include the NCOP members, you only include the NA members. And all parties holding more than 10 seats. Okay? They will have seats in the Joint Standing Committee on the
Defence.
No, according to the number, it works out proportionally if you look at it. And then the third rule is about the chairperson. It says the Joint Standing Committee on Defence must elect one of its members as chairperson. There's no provision for a deputy chair or a
co-chairperson.
The unfortunate thing is that the rules previously made provision for a chairperson from one house and a deputy chairperson from another house. And it doesn't, in none of the rules does it state that the chairperson must come from the MA and the deputy chairperson must come from the NCOP. It's just something that has evolved over the years. Because the NA is the business, because it's a larger house, it's happened. And I think the NCOP has now felt they want to.
That's how we had to resolve it, by simply saying that we have a chair, a co-chair person.
In the case of deputy chair. But the problem with Joint Standing Committee on Defence particularly is that there's no provision even for a deputy chair. But it also doesn't state, as Mr. Matthews said, from which house it's coming. So it can be an NCOP member, can be an NA member.
Can I address you on this?
Yes.
My concern is not with the size of the committee and the position of the deputy chair. We have a Joint Standing Committee on Defence. And then at the same time, we have portfolio committee. That's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we may need to deal with it at a political level, where we convince certain other people that, look, I just don't understand the motivation for having the two. Mm-hmm. Who are essentially doing the same thing, except that one involves members from the NCOP. And chairperson, let me put this on record. Defence is not a provincial, there's very little provincial involved in defence, if any. You may have certain armoured bases situated in certain governments, but other than that, it's a national competence. And I can make a strong argument for the NCOP not to be involved. Okay, fine, if they choose to be involved, so be it. But we shouldn't have two committees involved in the same thing as we have here. I really feel strongly about it, and at some point we need to address it. Whether this is the appropriate forum for it, I don't know. And to reiterate, maybe we'll need to take this to our political leaders. Yeah, and make a strong case there. There will be people who will be bruised and feel offended and hurt because taking away their status, so be it.
Yeah.
The only thing is that it's required by statute. I think that's why we've kept the joint committee all along, because it's required by statute.
Can I?
Fine, but then we do away with the portfolio committee. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah. You see, but some of us also serve on constitutional review committee, my political. political life, I'm supposed to be convener of the study group on the main rules committee. So in a sense, one is also looking beyond just the technical drafting of the aspects, but also saying that as we go along, we should be the eyes and ears of our respective parties on political or policy issues that may not strictly be before, but which at some or other point the rules committee is going to have to pronounce itself. So as we sensitize our parties to start reflecting on those things, because one of the things that made the rules committee dysfunctional to some extent in some eras of the institution is the indecisiveness of the institution, and the only reason why it's been indecisive was parties coming to the rules committee without a position, without having done the necessary to make sure that their system is going to make a decision. So what I'm hoping to achieve as well is to prompt a situation where, after we've said, we then sensitize our respective parties to say that there are things that need to be sorted out, you know? Let's have political positions as parties, so that even when the agenda of the world comes, we already know, and we can even put some of the things onto the agenda of the party, that next World Committee are able to resolve this issue. The Rules Committee is the highest political institution before the House, chaired by the presiding officer. So it should be able to make a decision. Now, some of the stuff may need constitutional amendments. They may want to formally refer them to a constitutional review committee, for example. Some of the stuff may need legislative changes, all right? There's nothing wrong with laws being amended. Doesn't mean that because it's in an act, it's going to stay like that permanently. And then it will be up to the Rules Committee to designate an appropriate committee to process the necessary, relevant legislation. So I'm just saying, let's think out of the box when we engage in this. In the past, in any case, we've had situations where we said, look, this is outside of our mandate because it goes to the Constitution. But nevertheless, somebody needs to do something about the Constitution. Alright, so maybe we could, as this committee, say that there is this matter. And we think that the Rules Committee may need to address it to the group. And then it will be up to the power that we to see how it is going to work. But in the meantime, parties are letter to the system and come to the Rules Committee. There's a number of issues actually that are stalling because of parties' opinion. What's the other thing that?
Well, what's been referred to the joint rules, and which also include that, the joint subcommittee on review of rules, is the report of the eminent person, the peer review mechanism, that report by the group of eminent persons, that's been referred to as for processes. So parties need to engage with that particular report to see what they want to take forward out of that report and what needs to happen there. But it hasn't been referred to us as a subcom yet. It's been referred to the joint rules there. To the joint rules. And then there's also Ms. Tohan's, this is also a joint issue, I think, Ms. Tohan's passing in the third parliament on the legislative process. There's a report available on that, and that was distributed to all joint rules members. We circulated a thick pack of legacy documents to members of the Rules Committee. If they just look in that pack, you'll find all the documents because it's quite bulky to keep on sending all those ones. But yeah, those are the two main.
How those things get processed, I'm not sure. Whether, you see, the tricky thing is that if you throw everything to Mr. Handick, that has not been processed politically and at a policy level, he starts working on the assumption that this thing is not pursued.
Mm-hmm.
And after a good day's or month's work, I want to find that to be swept all together. So it will help if in the meantime we push the old committee to get to making positive decisions on some of the hanging issues. So that, because, like I said at the beginning, our role normally is when all is said and done, and the consensus across the party at the level of the old committee on the policy and the way forward, that we then come in and talk. But we have a situation of an anomaly here where stuff has been referred in fact to us. We still need policy form, and that's why we are in turn throwing it to Mr. Handel's project. The issue of interpolation, for example, is a policy question. What does Mr. Handel do besides to reintroduce interpolation in the room? And then you go to the road committee and the agency say no to interpolation. And they use their majority to bulldoze the proposal after all the days, hard days work, So we just need to get our ducks in a row here. But I was just merely trying to highlight the fact that there are things that need policy or political process. And the party should be reminded in the recent society so that they continue their discussion at party level. Alright, now that should take us fairly off item 3, which is the broad discussion about the view of Jews. Is there anything else that I need to mention under the broad discussion?
I think we've covered more than
we need to. Okay. All right. Now, item 4, Money Bill Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. We are going to take a brief presentation of the. I don't know who's presenting.
Okay, can I to the committee just introduce? This is my colleague, Pervin Handy. Mr. Handik, some for those who don't know yet, it looks like he's there.
Right.
And then Chilisa Murukanele, who is one of our senior procedural officers in St. Angela. But Terran will be doing the first presentation.
Chairman, can I just call if I'd like one comment or ask a question?
Yes.
Are we going to finish the conference?
We're hoping. What time
we're
is
hoping.
It now?
We're hoping. It's now 11:30.
We still have an hour.
Is the concern I mentioned earlier about the fact whether this committee can make recommendations without a quorum. And I don't have an answer. Even a recommendation, deciding to make a recommendation to my mind is a decision.
Mm-hmm.
To decide to make a recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking aloud that we might run into problems based on a person like Dr. Mshini doesn't think that he offers to those meetings by the people who take a recommendation to which doesn't agree with him. Make sure it's not good. Procedural stand in the rules committee that the subcommittee made recommendations out of court.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, but it's a possibility. And the way to overcome that, and this is something from the old parliament which we use quite successfully, is to have a little round robin, as we used to call it, a one page document with a two liner or three liner per resolution. Our decision was we propose this, we propose that, we propose that, and each of the members sign next to it and mm-hmm. agree to it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we have a forum with new things today, but I'm just mentioning this possibility. Maybe this table can look at that point after which we didn't make issue of now. I don't know how. Mm-hmm. My personal view is that even making a recommendation effectively is a decision. So that's the only function of the setup of the subcommittee.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the power to take the resolution in any case. Mm-hmm. We can only make resolution, we can only make recommendations. The impact that we make a recommendation requires to mean that we decide to make a recommendation. It could be a solution. But I'll leave it there and just mention the point.
Mm. I see. It's important for us to make sure that if issues could become issues that could affect our processes, that we apply our mind to those and decide how we want to handle it. Is there any advice from selfishness on this issue?
It's a difficult one, because our experience with this particular committee, our experience with this particular committee is always that we have although you have a certain membership, you really have only a small number of members attending, because they normally have conflicting engagements, such as portfolio committees and things that they have to attend. So we've always just gone ahead and worked with an understanding. I mean, that should anyone have an objection to anything, they can come forward and you know, because what we will do is circulate the documents before it's final, circulate the documents to all members and say this is what was said. A summary of decisions should go out within the next 24 hours.
See, if you take it even to the extreme, that means that two persons, or even one person, can come sit here and say this is not a meeting, mm-hmm. Even which might mm-hmm. follow recommendations to this one.
Mm-hmm. But so the longer you have meetings like that regularly. I'm being facetious. I'm being facetious. But I don't have a solution. If the members don't attend, it's a very difficult thing for us to regulate.
But we have to talk as a way around is to send out the summary of decisions that we've taken, but also maybe attach a note to that saying if you have any series of questions about any of these decisions that we've taken, respond within this period of time and raise it with the secretary so that we're aware of that before it gets to a point where we say the
subcommittee
decided this and
we're
taking it
out of the room.
That
might
alleviate the
wrong problem. We've done something even more serious than that, but to actually recommend rule amendments to the rules committee without a quorum. Now, this is purely a technical thing of proposing the appointment of a consultant, and it's a matter that would still be discussed once all is sorted before the main rules committee ends, and ultimately the way I see it, the actual decision will be taken by the committee whether to appoint a consultant or not to trust the subcommittee. The subcommittee itself has been created in the rules committee. So, to me, it's more serious if it's a committee, because you know from the committee it goes straight to the house. If it's a subcommittee of a committee, let alone the committee itself is in the rules committee, do we only check the quorum issue in the rules committee?
Yes, for decisions we do. Look, we don't need a quorum to meet. Well, none of the committees need a quorum to meet, but for just for the decision.
For decision. But what is a decision? Are we making a decision? I think let's follow as a matter of course. Because invariably, otherwise we'll never get to do anything with this subcommittee. Because we'll never correct. I've shared it for 5 years. It's always been changed.
We've never had a quorum.
Now, how do you call people from the corridor, members from the corridor, to come and approve the proposal of appointing a consultant? Don't think we're setting
the way I think the extreme of the 10 will be that
I don't think we need to take it to those
issues.
I don't think we need to take them to those issues. I think the suggestion by
Tanya
is a more practical one. Let's put together something. Speculate to the members. The only difficulty of this is that if some members are back, what do you do? Do you take it back to the committee that they're not here to object? They object after the meeting. If JJ says, I'm still not convinced that we need a consultant.
Majority says yes.
just on another point, I think it's an important process to follow, because you don't want the subcommittee turning on itself in the board of rules committee. The rules committee is obviously looking for the subcommittee to come with a recommendation.
Yes.
And you wouldn't want a situation where you've got a member standing up and saying, I'm a member of the subcommittee and I don't think I'm a member and I wasn't part of the decision.
Well, I'll tell you what, Michael. Where I stand as chair of the subcom and present a report on behalf of the subcom, and one member of my own party comes and chops it into pieces.
No, I remember that.
When they're supposed to inspect the convener of our own study group on group. All right. Yeah, that would be the. Look, we don't have an intent. We'll never ever get a collapse. And the kind of stuff we do with is not scientists. You can use people as working tough, you know, with doing it. So the only way actually, as far as I can say, can we agree on that? All right. Let's move on to the experts on this animal called amending money bill. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chris, and good morning, members. Yes, I'll obviously be talking about the money bill and then the procedure and related matters. I'll obviously be talking to the presentation on the screen, but also deviating from the times and speaking in more general terms on certain issues. The presentation follows that order, so it's a little bit about the background, and then it goes into more details about the
Welcome, Mr. Anderson.
The instruments and processes in the Act itself.
On item 4. All right, please.
Thank you, Chair. Then I'll be talking a little bit about the implications and challenges. I'll obviously reflect on those as I deal with number 2 as well. And then the last one is just a brief comment on some of the, if you like, some of the processes within Parliament that are currently underway. And I think that's important because, as you probably note, the implementation of the Act will require quite a lot of political and administrative coordination. So I think it's important that that this committee, for example, works with a sense of awareness about what's going on one elsewhere. I'll obviously describe or explain that in more detail. As I'm sure everyone in this committee knows, Section 77(3) of the Constitution allows Parliament to amend money bills, but it must have a law to enable it to do so, to set out the procedure. And up until now, that obviously hasn't been in place. I am aware that this matter has been under discussion for some time. It was obviously raised as part of Parliament's review of its oversight processes, I think way back in 1999. It formed part of the report by the Subcommittee on Oversight and Accountability, I think. And most recently, it was referenced in the oversight model as well, which had a chapter on amending budgets. In 2008, fairly late in the year, the National Assembly resolved that the Portfolio Committee on Finance should introduce a bill. That was done on, I think, the 10th of October and agreed to by the National Assembly, at least on the 23rd of October. The actual Act was assented to on the 16th of April this year. I'll get obviously to explain those things in more detail. Before I get to the specifics of the Act, I think it might be useful just to explain very briefly the budget process, because the Act really tries to, I wouldn't perhaps say mirror, but match the budget process. Certain provisions, certain processes are trying to influence different parts of the budget. Traditionally, the budget process has been divided into three phases: the drafting phase, which obviously takes place predominantly in the executive; the legislative phase, when the budget is actually tabled; and the implementation phase, when the governments go ahead and spend money. Parliament has, up until now, actually played a role in all these phases through different instruments and different processes, although perhaps not as robustly or systematically as it could have done. And I think that is one of the motivations for this act, which tries to systematize, if you like, this whole process within Parliament. Those are some of the instruments which Parliament has used, the medium-term budget policy statement, the national budget, and so on. I think the point that's been made here is that the budget really impacts on everything Parliament does. In terms of attempting to influence policy, in terms of obviously dealing with the bills themselves, but also in terms of its general oversight. When departments are spending money, it's really about the implementation of the budget. So this act has really quite far-reaching implications for the entire way the Parliament goes about its work. So it's fairly intimidating, I think, for someone who hasn't perhaps seen it or studied it. The implications, which we are still trying to understand, are also fairly large. One of the problems I have in preparing this presentation, I think, was the fact that the act is very technical, very complicated. And obviously with a fairly short space of time, I must try and summarize them, but also give the members a sense of the task that is in front of them. So that's fairly challenging. I hope I can achieve that by the end.
Can I just maybe interrupt you there and say that we are mindful of that? Obviously, this is the first meeting. We don't envisage the situation where such a complex thing can really go through it in one day. It obviously is going to be one of the stuff that's going to go into the review process on because of it is not. So we're going to have to work out rules here and now. But one of the things that we're going to have to do is to propose that we have a full day or two workshop on this to really go through the rule implications of this. Maybe you'll also touch on some of the things that are problematic with whatever things that may need to be relooked at. And we'll need to understand where that process is going to happen, or reflecting on the act, or where it actually happens. Because maybe some people somewhere are already engaging with this act and saying, but some of those things, can they really work? But for today, just do the bit that you can so that we have a taste of it.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, I'll try and be succinct and to the point, but also hopefully descriptive as well. I think just to ignore the slide for the moment, I think one of the most interesting and perhaps challenging aspects of the Act is Section 3, which is the application. I don't know if all members have the Act in front of them, but this gives perhaps a taste of some of the difficulties about understanding the implications of the legislation. Section 3 says this Act applies to all proposed amendments to money bills before Parliament. Now that provision can actually be interpreted in different ways. Because what the Act does is it puts in place certain structures and processes and mechanisms for Parliament to engage with the budget in different stages and ultimately to amend the budget when the budget is actually tabled in Parliament. Now, if you read this provision, it seems one interpretation would be that this Act only needs to be applied if Parliament actually wants to amend the budget.
Mm.
But the other interpretation, and if I may say the one I favour, is that Parliament is never knows whether it wants to, is going to propose amendments to a particular budget. So the systems and other provisions that the Act provides for still have to be put in place. Now, but those are two interpretations. We have a legal opinion, I think, which actually suggests the first. But that is the first, I think, major, if you like, interesting point in the Act. To move on to Section 4, which deals with the committee.
Well, there's a third possible interpretation.
Maybe I'll be.
Let me tell you, I was once the legal advisor in the government department, and we had to deal with an issue
And we ended up with 7 different legal opinions on that issue. The advisor to the president then had a different opinion. The advisor to the deputy president had a different opinion. The advisor to the speaker had a different opinion. And the advisor to the premier of Western Cape had a different opinion. In fact, they wanted to take the law to the Constitutional Court at the time, which we thought would resolve the problem, because at least we would have a court decision on the question. But let me put this in passing. You see, I could interpret it to mean that obviously this act applies to what it explicitly says it applies to. If the act, for example, regulates a procedure in respect of the processing of a bill in a particular context, that's what the act says, and that's what happens. But so that need not be dealt with here. But what then gets dealt with here is to say that in addition to that, in case uncertainty arises, insofar as an amendment is concerned, proposed amendment to the budget is concerned, please note that whether the Act is explicit about it elsewhere or not, consider it as being explicit, explicitly so, or impliedly so, that this Act is applied. In other words, this Act regulates specific matters and procedures to be applied in respect to specific matters. All right? But in case there's uncertainty, insofar as amendments of the budget is concerned, be informed that this Act will apply in all situations of amendments. So it's like a catch-all phrase at the end, in case something leaks, that's how it says. Unless your second interpretation is actually.
Three lawyers in a room filed different legal opinions.
I'm sure of it.
I've applied my mind to this question very summarily, but it seems to me that what this piece of legislation does is take in place an entire process for the handling of both the appropriation side and the remuneration side legislation by Parliament. So it is really the framework.
Yes.
Section 1 is a misnomer because the redundant confinement was what it deals with. It doesn't deal only with proposed amendments. It sets up the entire process imposing obligations on the minister on how to introduce legislation from the support.
They're saying even the name of the act is a bit of a misnomer.
Well,
it's
the entire process of handling this type of legislation through Parliament, whether or not
it may end up being amended in the
process. This is the only track for this legislation to follow as it goes through Parliament, irrespective of whether or not Parliament would amend it. Am I correct?
In fact, that's confirming my opinion, because what I'm saying is that to the extent that this Act deals with anything else other than amendment of money bills, all right, that would have been explicitly provided for in the Act. So you give a classical example of one where it deals with the whole procedure of handling those without dealing with the men. All right?
It should be the morning deal, a procedure and related matters.
Yeah. Now, I'm saying, in light with what you have just said, that this Act is not confined to amendment of money. It deals with procedures for the handling of money bills, all right? Mm. But what Clause 3 does is to this make you aware that in case, in your interpretation of this, there is some doubt, you know, as to whether there are certain aspects relating to amendment that have not been explicitly dealt with yet, which is the narrower issue. Be informed that any such issue relating to amendment of many bills in respect of any of such issues is back to law.
And just a minute, let me draw your attention. Actually, you feel it in the fact that it's nicely drafted because it tells us how to interpret it. And it tells us in section 2A that it must be so interpreted to give effect to the constitutional authority of the National Assembly. So basically, means if you need to choose between two interpretations, this would give great chance to the National Assembly, great power that needs to be preferable. And it is really behind this because the constitutional authority lies being and powerful, the principle of no taxation without representation. So I would find it difficult for anyone to say that this bill doesn't apply because the parliament is not going to amend the things, or it doesn't apply until and unless parliament wishes to amend it.
You said that there is an opinion preferring a particular interpretation. Is that the first? Which one is the first interpretation?
There is an opinion, a legal opinion. There's certainly an opinion by one of the lawyers in Parliament that suggests that this act only need apply if Parliament is actually going to
amend.
Now, that's not necessarily the view that we...
But that's not what this clause says. Would you disagree?
If I may, Chair, I find this clause a little bit
ambiguous. Mr. Ambrosini is saying read the clause 3 with clause 2.
Yeah, but also what this law says that if you're going to amend this legislation, that's how you do it. But that's not what this bill is all about.
Yeah.
And it's contrary to the next provision tells you this. So what really this law meant to say, you can only amend one bill as set out in the hearing. And that's how it should have read.
You see, what it could have read is that this act applies something like only in respect of any proposed amendment to money bills by Parliament, before Parliament. Then it would have been explicit to say it's only if amendments are being proposed that this act would apply. But that's not what this law says. And the legislator could have said so. He chose, or she chose, to say otherwise. But clearly the intention is different.
Legal services needs...
Legal services, where are you?
Legal services
are new. Why is behind us? Why are you not amongst us?
No, it's one of the steps.
Come forward and tell us about your legal opinion.
Why are the legal services prepared to render the opinion? My suggestion is that there is great relevance in the discussion we are having, because formulating whatever rules is implemented in the legislation, we have the latitude and the option and the possibility of clarifying any doubt. And the rules will need to take the process just by saying all money bills are referred by the in the rules that we rank, all money bills are referred to the Finance Committee. It shall be processed in terms of the money bills amendment to federal related matters act. We are adopting
the rule to that effect.
This is say we need the number, interpretation number 2, which is the one we think all around the table, all things.
That would be an interpretation that we're putting into the rules, and obviously I cannot see that contradicting the act, because as far as I'm concerned, the clause is fairly clear. It was not intended to deal. It was not intended to impose any limitation. It was intended to actually prevent a leakage or a gap, an envisage to get, where something relating specifically to amendment of many bills could be interpreted as not being regulated by this act, or this act not applied to it. So anything that has to do with money bill, clause 3 makes it clear this act will affect it. Now, is anybody going to convince us otherwise? Let's just hear the legal section.
Yes.
Do you want to comment before the legal section?
No, I'm fine. I have my views. I'm not sure.
Do you want to share your views at this point so that the legal section can respond to all of
them? My views are those expressed by the chairperson. And I'm not worried by the legal opinion because just looking at the provisions of the Act, it is clear that the intention, or despite what is intended to, the intention is to put in place procedures to deal with
manager. And it makes sense. Why deal with the matter piece while you can deal with it holistically?
Yeah.
At what point do you get to know in the first place whether you're going to want to amend? Because amending can also be an issue that arises along the way, isn't it so? But yes.
Chip, I know you asked the legal services for comment, but if I could maybe just take you to something I was going to mention a lot later, and this is one of the reasons that I pointed this provision out to
you. Yes, and thank you for pointing it out.
The discussion is interesting. Because this Act does not contain transitional arrangements.
All right.
So it is in force now.
Yeah.
And the way you interpret number 3...
Mm-hmm. So already we are in trouble. That's what you want to tell us.
So if, for example, if the Act only applied in the case where you wanted to propose amendments and not otherwise, then this Act, in fact, wouldn't be in force.
Mm-hmm.
But the second interpretation means, and the one that really, to me, is self-evident, this means that these provisions should be enforced now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is the case in some...
So we're already in breach of the law.
that's
basically what you're telling me.
No,
he's not saying that. He's saying, in line with what Mr. Ambrosini said earlier, by way of pointing us to clause 1, section 1, that clearly outlines the procedure of handling money bills, irrespective of whether ultimately amendments would follow or not.
Even without the rules that we have proposed.
We'll come to that point.
I think that initially with Michael and this debate, it would be desirable to have rules to implement this act.
Yes.
But are those rules necessary? I mean, a very summary, very unattractive thing that is quite self-implementing.
Well, let's get to that point. Let's get to that point. But just too quickly, that's why I also deferred your issue about rules, because that's the other thing. But the issue that's being raised is that it may well be that even in terms of the procedures in this act, as we said, we may have processed stuff outside of the framework of this, not in full compliance with this act, and that may already have put the processes that were followed since the application of this act in some kind of difficulty. We had a similar situation with the Powers and Privileges Act. It came into operation instantly, and we had to catch up with it along the way with certain rule adjustments. But there's two... Somebody says to that for you.
It took us 4 years to get up.
But there's two possibilities. If in the event a case is made to the effect that in fact Parliament has not been in compliance, then we may have to urgently ask Parliament to amend clause 3 so that at this stage plus 3 applies only in respect of k, well, rather, that the x applies only in respect where actual amendments are envisaged. And the question may be, at what point is that point determined so that the operations of the act, because look, if the decision is taken midway that we want to amend when the bills have already been introduced, what do we do? Do we reintroduce in order to follow the state that are envisaged in the act? You know, those kind of questions. So it's a bit of a complicated issue. But let me not, before I go rambling further, let me give the opportunity to the legal question. Obviously, we've had the time to look at all of this, and maybe you can provide us some insight.
I don't know if I've got my resident in the room,
because I have not
seen
the
legal opinion, which is
given
by the
committee,
and my
judgment
of...
Where is the colleague?
Advised that
is contrary to the committee. Hmm? Oh, there was somebody else.
I have seen that the legal advisor is Mr. Jenkins, who was involved in the drafting of the act.
So where's Mr. Jenkins?
Now
he should have been the one that presents the opinion. We prefer the author of the opinion, irrespective of the new deployment, to be the presenter of their own opinion. Because an opinion is a personal thing. You can't speak on behalf of somebody else's opinion.
My opinion, okay, is I think what I agree with the opinion that was given previously, but I read the section again, and it says this act applies to all proposed amendments. Like you were saying, you say it covers proposed amendments, it doesn't include anything else that's covered by the act. Mm-hmm. And I think that is because this act came from Section 72, which requires that legislation be with the procedure for amending many bills. But in the process of doing that, Parliament went over
beyond
that,
what Section 77
intended. And what was being attempted in Section 3 is to say whatever else is covered in the Act, you can't include a managing amendment from the application of the Act. So it applies to all the proposed amendments, but that does not include other things that are covered by the Act. So you can't say that, which then brings that thing that we haven't complied. And we can't exclude that because the government by the Constitution to cover this amendment when we have gone beyond what was required by the Constitution.
Mr. Ambrosini, your assertion in relation to 2A, well, if the Constitution says we need legislation to deal specifically with money bills, amendments to money bills, clearly this act has exceeded the Constitution, as you said. And if the act had confined itself to cases where amendments are involved, should have been fully compliant with the Constitution.
Well,
let's have a third of it.
My conviction is that the Constitution requires that certain things to be legislated.
Yeah.
And those things are legislated. But the Constitution gives Parliament the plenary power to legislate about anything it wishes.
Yes, but beyond what it is.
Yes, exactly. So the fact that it's in one bill or two bills, it makes no difference.
Yes.
It's a matter of coherence. I think I read it now quickly, but it seems to me a very nice deal. But I think with Mr. Chairman,
I can see you like it. It's really nice.
No, it's a fact. I mean, that's the piece of legislation. It's really pretty nice to understand what it means. It's nice to be granted.
Especially in the light of your assertion in that principle. Oh. No taxation without representation. I think we should record that in a minute.
But let's move forward. I think that we proceeded from a question. Mr.
Hendrick.
There are two possibilities of reading this action. The one that the act
only triggered into application when somebody wants to propose an amendment. The other one is applied generally, and that all amendments are subject to it. I think that we are all in agreement that only the second interpretation is conceivable, because otherwise the provision seeks to say at least 3 months prior to the introduction of the national budget, the minister must submit to Parliament a medium-term policy statement. It wouldn't be applicable until somebody stands down and says, I want to amend it. That's just impossible.
Yeah.
So, if we are in agreement, we should proceed. I'm with you.
Now, where does all of that leave us? Simplified, the Parliament must then go on this overdrive to make sure that all its institutions are reconditioned to be in full compliance of the Act, and that's the only way out. Because I can't see how you can suppress part of it, of the Act, insofar as saying that the Act will only apply only in relation to amendments. Because if you start using it, say, how do you know that amendments will be involved or not?
If we leave out the tech part, if you don't consider the other level is amended or not, but if you don't consider in terms of the Act, the implication might be that you will not be able to amend because it's in compliance.
Look, that's part of the problem, but the problem is even bigger than that. The problem is that the whole process may be flawed if it's not in full compliance with the provisions of the Act. So that's my even bigger worry. Amending or not amending the budget, to me, the initial stages of driving this thing is not so much my biggest worry. It would be nice for people to want to amend the budget just to get the Act to work first and work properly, with or without amendments to the budget. It's a much more bigger nightmare.
I think that you are correct in saying that fundamentally it means that the institution is going to overdrive.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, notwithstanding any kind of challenges that may later arise, it has to move.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the challenge perhaps for this committee is that notwithstanding that it is a fairly detailed piece of legislation, and it does prescribe a lot of processes in great detail.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them can be implemented without rules.
Hmm.
And I think if I could just move on to Section 4, for example, where it talks about parliamentary committees for the consideration of money bills.
Yeah.
This Act establishes 4 committees, 2 in each house, a standing committee on finance and a standing committee on appropriations.
Hmm.
Now, those committees have been established, and they are functional. They have obviously slightly different roles. The finance committees are really mandated in terms of the Act to look at what I suppose might be considered macroeconomic policy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the appropriations committees have a more coordinating function, and they really look at budgets themselves, so
mm-hmm.
departmental line budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Now you'll see, for example, in Section 4, sub 5, it says the standing rules must provide for, and then it gives a number of specifications. The composition of the committees, the election of the chairpersons, and any other related matters, etc.
Mm.
Now, those may be required in time. In fact, it would be true, I think, to say that these committees must be put into the rules.
Mm.
But the fact that they aren't in the rules, the fact that the Act actually established them, means that they are functioning already.
Mm.
Now,
in fact, the rules have established them, because even though the rules are not expressly established, portfolio committees have been determined, and that includes those committees, and their composition has been by resolution of the House. I think that could be interpreted in that
way. But I think the challenge I was going to say, sir, is that some of the processes, this is a fairly section 4 is fairly clear and straightforward. But some of the other processes will require rules. And in the absence of those rules, those processes are going to be very difficult to implement. So I think that is the challenge.
Are those rules difficult? I'm trying to get to a point where we say, look, this thing is alive. Let's confine ourselves to our responsibility in this regard, which is to give full effect to the act by way of adopting the necessary rules, whether they are expressly required by the act or not, but which are necessary to give full expression to the provisions of the act. If there are serious problems like clause 3, which I'm not even sure what necessary is for, can simply be deleted, apart from being helpful and being problematic. We could recommend amendments to the Act, but that's a separate issue. For now, I think we should confine ourselves to the question, to give full effect to this, do we need rules, what rules, and start putting those rules together. Put them through to the rules committee, get them through. Unfortunately, they may have been stuck missed with the previous processes. Trying to come to somebody else to make a fuss about it. It's not our job. Our job is to make rules, to give effect. So let's see where we go insofar as that's concerned. Like I said, we might not exhaust everything today because of constraints on time. But in the process, if you want to address us on problematic clauses like you pointed out to three, do so in fact. But yeah.
There are a number of those, but we can obviously get to them as we go through it. I think that one needs to understand certain provisions in the context of broader processes. So my initial idea was simply to describe the processes and highlight where rule amendments may be necessary.
What may be necessary, yes.
So we've dealt with section 4, which is the establishment of these committees. The next section deals with what they call section 5, which is procedure prior to the introduction of the budget. And that's up on the board there.
Okay, before you move to section 5, should we not address section 4
No, sir. I think just indicating that section 4 was not in the tabulated presentation, but obviously I'll highlight.
Now, my proposal in relation to 4.5, which is that is that it does not necessarily have to be interpreted mechanically. I think all it's saying is that whatever the rules prescribe on how committees of this kind should be established, that would be dealt with in rules.
Yeah.
And what you actually have, and have in fact done, is that you did actually establish this committee by a resolution of the last rules committee and the House in terms of the formulas.
Yes. If I may, just to add to it, I do agree that the establishment is not an issue. They're established by statute. The under A, the
not only by statute, but in fact.
Yes, by the
we have in fact.
Yes, the constitution we have taken care of.
Right.
The election of the chairperson, I think we've taken off, it follows from the general rules on the election of the chairperson.
Yeah.
The functions of the committee, in addition to those stipulated in this act, this is something that I read that we may or may not. If we've got something else, some more work to do.
All right.
If we want to give them more work, we need to do it by rules, but it's not something urgent.
All right.
Now, D, it seems to me that it's something that would require our attention. The consultation between the respective committees on finance of each house. Now, I don't see anything in the rules which would be responsive to this. And it seems to me that we must have a process of some sort. I wouldn't know how that would be implemented between with the convening provision, or perhaps they should consult once every year. I don't know what type of content this provision calls for, how often, who convenes the meeting, what else. Then we're dealing with being. And sorry, it is the same. So D and E are the same. So
So this is the only concept. Then the additional concept that we may want to consider, which I don't think we have to, which would fall under any other matter, this deal of the act puts in place additional processes in Parliament which before were not there. The tabling of a clear budget, all the things that the minister must do, which are of enormous importance to the process. So we may need to consider how Parliament interacts with this document in point of discussion, in point of resolution, in point of giving lots of time to speak to the minority. But I think these are the relevant issues which seem to be arising in point of writing rules out of this field of design.
How about that stuff? Political stuff in the sense that where there are blanks, filling those blanks really depends on whatever country wants to propose by way of the content of that process. You may choose not to fill the blank at all.
And there is another decision that I'm suggesting,
which
is the chairman that I think made to make. These, to a certain extent, what it is in the deal are rules. I mean, when you read that the National Assembly, the National Council of Provinces must refer the fiscal framework and regional proposal to the respective committee of finance. The committee must conduct one public hearing on the fiscal framework or regional proposal. The committee must, within 15 days after the delivery of the national budget, must submit a report to the National Assembly. It goes on and on. Mm-hmm. But these are all things that, generally speaking, one would find in the rules.
See, that's the other worry.
So one thing that we could do if we wanted just to list it out of the app and copy it in the rules. Because then we got one document which to the presiding officer, to the speaker,
that outlines the whole process.
Outlines all the process and all these things. But that's obviously it's a decision that is committed to make.
We've done that before. We've repeated what's in the Constitution, haven't we?
No, we decided we will not repeat what's in that, and we will stick to the phone.
Yeah.
So if something is contending, I have to leave it there. And
has that been our consistent
approach? For example, do you remember the one on the speech to the rules on the Committee of the AC? Remember that? Your committee. remember all this?
Unless we say in addition to what is contained.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that, obviously, this is not a guide. I mean, we can repeat things in a guide, but if this is an extension of law, then ordinarily you wouldn't regurgitate what's already in the law in another legal instrument.
Otherwise, if you want to follow that approach, if I may, Mr. Chairman, you may want to consider having a different publication of this book in which we...
The layperson's text.
No. Very much against the person's application, it was confusing. No, we got the book and then we got a couple of appendices. I mean, at the end, we put those provisions of the Constitution, which relate to the compass of the business of the house. And we can put these provisions of the bill, which again relate, so that they're not part of the rules, but they're a reference
That's a brilliant idea. That's a good, so that there's easy cross-referencing in the same direction.
And we don't need to say copyright.
No copyright arises out of legislative. But. All right.
Thank you, Chair. I think Professor Rasheed is correct in the sense that a lot of the Act actually reads like rules. And there are specific reasons for that. And one of the reasons being that it's almost a check. In other words, amending budgets is seen as a politically sensitive issue.
Mm-hmm.
So the requirements in the Act are quite strict.
Mm-hmm.
But it also gives rise to the concern is that where things are difficult to implement, if it were in the rules, you could
amend
House resolution, you could just go to the House. But because
but if it's
the
in the Act, then you can't do it.
And you can't suspend it.
Yeah. Exactly. So you're bound to it. And that's...
I thought you said you can.
It's both a good thing and a bad thing. I
got lots of the accent there. All right. Yes, that's correct.
If I can move on to section 5, sir, which is the procedure prior to the introduction of the budget. This section really talks about, and this is up on the presentation really generally, simply indicates that every committee in the National Assembly, not only in the NCFT, every committee in the National Assembly must, on an annual basis, assess the performance of each department with reference to the following, and then it lists a whole range of issues that these committees must take into account. The medium-term expenditure priorities of each department, the strategic plans, and so on. Now, based on that assessment, each committee must annually submit what they call a budget review and recommendation report for tabling in the National Assembly. That's section or subsection 2. Now, in a sense, these reports must be tabled at a certain time, after the budget has been adopted, but before Parliament adopts a report on the medium-term expenditure framework, which is generally in October, early November. Now, the purpose of these reports, these are very important mechanism in respect of the Act. It's in fact the first step that Parliament must take towards ultimately amending when finally budgets are tabled. Now, again, this is one of those provisions which, committees are currently, in fact, mandated to do this. They should be annually assessing the performance of each department, that is their function. It may not be in terms of the strict criteria that are in the Act in terms of sub 1.
Sub 1 of?
Five, section 5, sub 1, and then list the actual functions, the tasks that these committees must do. These reports must be submitted to the responsible cabinet minister. Before they are tabled, after adoption of these reports by the National Assembly, they are forwarded to the responsible minister as well as the Minister of Finance. One of the issues that there have been a number of questions around this particular section, even though it's relatively straightforward, and as I said, these things are almost applied at this point. The first is the timing of it. Because the Act says that these reports must be submitted before the adoption of the medium-term budget policy statement in October, really early November, that means that these reports could technically be tabled in October, or in late October, early November, which means that the House would suddenly have a huge list of reports to process. That's the first point. The second point is that the purpose of these reports is partially so the Treasury is able to incorporate the recommendations into preparing for the next budget. Now, the concern with that from Treasury's point of view, and we've had a few discussions with them, is that that is fairly late in the process. It's fairly, in other words, the budget has almost been finalized by that point. They're still waiting for a few key figures. So their perspective is that if they are to incorporate meaningfully these recommendations into the budget, these reports should be tabled as early as possible. Submitted and adopted.
Why does that early
the adoption of the budget.
So it could be before October at any stage. Now, one of the interesting aspects of this is that.
And this date must be tabled by when?
Before the adoption by Parliament of the report on the medium term budget policy statement.
Which is when?
Which is probably, let's say November.
Yeah.
Sure. So that's late in the process.
That's late in the process. So the rules, for example, may need to specify that notwithstanding the provisions of the Act, these committees should in fact submit these reports by October or some point earlier, just simply earlier than
the... You can't wait because you haven't adopted the budget thing yet. You just wait for the budget to be adopted before you can table the report.
But the other complication...
But when is the budget adopted?
Normally in June. June.
Third
week in
June. Possible, but... Obviously, you need to look at recess periods and when Parliament's sitting and when committees are sitting and when they have time to do these things.
The whole recess thing may be significantly impacted upon the Parliament's those specific committees.
Yeah. That's correct. The other thing.
But can I just quickly ask a question? To what extent has the relevant committees been taken through this? Are they fully conscious of this? Are they applying it? Who can with confidence tell us what's happening there?
I'll say no. Well, I understand I'm
convinced. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go to it because I don't go to workshop on BLT, which I can read myself, but the committee held the workshop on BLT.
Alright. So they, and are they applying it?
Well, it has been applied. I mean, as far as the committee is concerned, which, I mean, what is required here, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't substantially alter what the committee itself does.
You're saying that we may be stirring up a big storm in a teacup.
It has been workshop in the finance committee. I think that all we need to look at is, I mean, I don't know whether this committee can take and bear the responsibility of educating the rest of parliament. But I know that my colleague, Senator Singer, also went to a senior workshop in the appropriation committee.
No. All we're saying is that as long as we're satisfied that people are conscious of this and apply it, we know historically there's been provisions and powers and privileges which were not, you know, in application even though the Act is already in operation. But that's fine. Yes, Mr. Mulugami?
As part of the implementation of the oversight model, the Speaker and the Chairperson of the SSC have sent out a memo that they should at least be two workshops on the Monday among the ministry. That was a very big announcement on Friday. But it's not clear who should be part of
that workshop. I think the subcommittee will need to attend it. Purely in order to also have the opportunity to speak with one mind insofar as issues that relate to us. Because they could come up with things that we might have difficulty with when we come to actually drafting the rules.
I think that's what we are looking at. We are putting a proposal in here.
So there won't be a need for us to have a separate workshop.
Perhaps you might find a need specifically because what I think is happening today.
Maybe consequent to that, we can have a
bit. The general principles that will definitely inform your rule amendment. But specifically for those
rules,
Mr. Handy?
Thank you, sir. I just wanted to just indicate maybe because I can see the way these discussions are unfolding. As Sadiso said, the Speaker has appointed the Speaker and the Chairperson. We have appointed a political task team to consist of some of the House Chairs, the Chairpersons of the Committee, Finance Committee and Appropriations Committee. And I think, certainly this was the agreement, with the chair of the subcommittees and the rules, both houses. And the idea of that task team would be essentially to develop an implementation plan for the Act. And part of that is indeed developing the necessary rules. But as you say, so some of the rules are contingent on some other decisions taken around certain provisions. So I think at this stage, it seems to me that will be, from a political point of view, sort of the driving mechanism, but that other structures, such as the Rules Committee, such as the Program Committee, because this will affect the program, will need to just get guidance from them and work in terms of a structured way. So that's the last point in my slide, so I'm actually jumping right.
Okay, when it comes to actual amendment of the rules, you know, we would have to refer that formally to this. Subcom, so that we sit as such to consider amendment. Can be sitting in some other structure and amending the rules without reference to the subcom.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, sir. If I could just proceed, one other issue, and maybe we're getting too technical. I'm aware that time constraints are a problem.
Just highlight the one or two last key issues that you think at this stage you need to bring to our attention. On the basis that we're going to pause and not exhaust the matter and defer it for another occasion where we can
have a much more dedicated time.
There are, as I said, it's obviously very technical, so I think this, you know, we could discuss this in a great level of detail.
Right.
I think maybe just to skip, just in terms of processes, one of the new processes in this Act, which hasn't been really followed before, it's got to do with the national budget itself. And you'll see, in terms of the Act, there are now three stages to the national budget.
Mm-hmm.
The first is what they call the fiscal framework, followed by the division of revenue, followed by the appropriation bill itself. Now, all these mechanisms are introduced at the same time by the Minister of Finance, but they are dealt with sequentially. And that is simply because if you amend, for example, the fiscal framework, let's put it the other way, you can't deal with the appropriation bill before you have a good understanding of the entire fiscal envelope and the amount of revenue that you're going to generate. So that's why there's a pattern that is followed, a particular sequence. Now, just to give you a broad sense, the minister tables these three instruments. Fiscal framework is referred first to the Finance Committee, which is given a specific amount of time to respond, 16 days in terms of the Act, 16 working days. Once Parliament then agrees, or the National Assembly agrees to the fiscal framework, which is instead the broad macroeconomic outline, if you like. Now, notably, that hasn't been, that's never been tabled before formally. You have a fiscal framework in the budget review and in other Treasury documents, but there's no specific document called the fiscal framework. So Treasury, that's a new thing for Treasury as well. Parliament is empowered to, in fact, amend the fiscal framework. Now, that's obviously, when you're talking about broad figures, you need a lot of information, you need to be very certain of what you're proposing if you're trying to amend that.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you're going to be changing tax policy, or you're going to be changing the level of debt-GDP ratio, all of those types of issues. So it's a very complex thing.
Mm-hmm.
Once the fiscal framework has been adopted by Parliament, in other words, the Finance Committee has reported, then the Division of Revenue Bill is referred, so in other words, these instruments sit with the Speaker. Fiscal framework is adopted, then the Division of Revenue is essentially referred to the Committee on Appropriations. It's referred back to this House when the committee is agreed and adopted. Then the Appropriation Bill is referred. Now, the appropriation is sequential. Now, the Appropriation Bill is referred to the Appropriations Committee, which then basically receives inputs from other committees. So other committees sit and deliberate on their departmental budget votes, make recommendations in terms of whether these should be amended or not, and makes, firstly, it's not clear necessarily whether these committees should report to the House, or, but the Act does say that they must make submissions to the Appropriations Committee, which then sits and deliberates on all these different inputs from the different portfolio committees. Finally, it then tables a report. It is allowed to, the Appropriations Committee is in fact empowered to disagree with the portfolio committee. So it has a level of political authority which perhaps committees don't, and no other committee has at this point. It then reports to the House, which is considered the first reading, and they have a debate on that report, which is the first reading debate. Now, the Act is also silent on budget debates in the House. So the way we read the bill is that the budget votes would only start occurring once the Appropriations Committee has, in fact, tabled its report, which would then be considered the first reading of the budget.
Yeah.
But that does, obviously, one must then be aware of the time frames needed for each of these steps, because if the Appropriations Committee must sit and deliberate on the submissions of different portfolio committees, it must also engage the public, it must then compile a report, which is going to be a long technical, potentially, anyway, complicated report, then submits to the House. Now, that would probably take you into April, I would think, perhaps April, early April. It's only at that point that budget debates can start. So that will again have implications for the parliamentary progress. The other thing I'd just like to highlight, because of time, this is even more complex than I'm explaining it, is the question of the division of revenue. Now, we've also had input from Treasury on this bill, on this Act. Treasury have a concern that in terms of current practice, the division of revenue is usually passed by the 1st of
March.
Yeah. Before the end of the financial year. And the reason is because when it comes to transferring monies, money funds to provinces, they need that act to enable those transfers to go through so the provinces can start spending funds. Now, this act allows Parliament, that's both houses of Parliament, 35 days after the adoption of the fiscal framework to consider and to the division of revenue. Now, if, for example, the budget is tabled in mid-February, 16 days to consider the fiscal framework ends, leaves you, 16 working days leaves you into early March, possibly, yeah, about mid-March, I would say. And then Parliament takes 35 days, and the reason the 35-day time frame is in the Act is because the division of revenue is obviously a Section 76 bill, so the provinces must be consulted. In terms of current practice, provinces have probably been a bit short-changed in terms of the amount of time that they've had. This bill says that Parliament must pass the division of revenue within 35 days. So potentially they could take 35 days, which means we work this out and take you into April, May.
Mm-hmm.
May sometime. Now Treasury, that concerns Treasury greatly. Then for a month or two, provinces will not be able to get certain funds.
Current practice is that by the 31st of the 28th of February, they should have got the money.
And
the
unfortunately, that
so
option was considered.
So you're saying that the implication could be that the budget speech comes far much earlier?
That was certainly something that Treasury has discussed. And I think when they're trying to understand how they can affect this act, they looked at all the different options.
Mm.
Their concern with tabling it earlier, obviously with the MTBBS, you can get a general indication of what the division of revenue may look like for the next year.
Mm.
But they can only finalize it in January,
mm.
And in fact early February, because they are waiting for the December revenue figures.
Mm.
That's obviously a time when they need to. And if you table it any earlier, their concern is that they really guess about how much money they can actually have. So there are some discussions, which to be brief, there are some discussions which need to take place around the sequencing of these instruments and what these things will mean for Treasury and for Parliament. Whether you can still say, look, the Act simply sets an outer time frame. So you can still have a political agreement that some of these bills can be adopted earlier. Without necessarily, but then, as I said, someone's going to have to be shortchanged. So that's just maybe.
And it will probably not be Mr. Ambrose then.
Is there a solution whereby we can amend the Act to overcome
that? As I said, the task team, which has been set up by the Speaker,
would also have to look at them.
Would have to look at all these things like problems. And they would have to come up, one of their functions would be to say, if something is ultimately unworkable, and that there is no solution, whether political or technical, legal solution, then you have to be able to amend the Act.
Is there any other issue relating to this Act without which, if you didn't mention it today, specifically the guys will fall?
According to 720.
No. Obviously, we haven't done justice to this measure. I'm not sure if we can, in fact, do justice to it before this invitation workshop. How soon is this invitation?
There's no time frame now. We're putting a proposal together.
I don't think us, in any case, finalizing rules when they're still hanging things. Such as possible amendments to the Act itself being mooted, such as certain time frames having still to be negotiated between the stakeholders, that is, Treasury on the one hand, Parliament on the other, and the executive committees and so on. And Sam Rafinha has been heard in the process and so on. Now, I think that if the workshop is going to happen soon, maybe we could leave matters at that until that workshop happens. And obviously, in the meantime, the other processes give further guidance.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
While I accept your wisdom,
the fact is that these acts is of course to the state today. And it could be implemented and it could be dealt with. I mean, dare we not find ourselves in a situation where some nasty challenges the validity of the revenue deal or the division because they didn't respect the law, which could happen. So we need to operate under this. But my suggestion, our suggestion, is that we give a mandate to draft any amendment of rules that may be deemed, and we take it real fast that this is drafted. No harm is done. So we apply our mind to those drafts, and then also we'll find out some of the issues between the
Handic.
So it means the Handic is not the opportunity of presenting today. And then we apply our mind to the state of the issue. Because even amending an act takes time. I think that the big problem here is that nobody wants to work between the 15th of December and the 15th of January. Mm-hmm. So there is a month which is taken out of the parliamentary calendar. But if one should track that month in the calendar, this actually works very well.
What about the constituents?
The rest of the people out there.
Well, they don't.
Besides, I don't recall taking leave in the 10 years of that.
Me neither.
Because it's always your constituency office. They don't work according to parliament leave calendar. But the reality is that we should accept the reality also that members do need to service their constituency. Look, I lean more in favor of your proposal that the table staff must go back and look at areas where explicit rules are required under the Act. And make sure that, unless there are complications, those draft rules are put together so that we can start looking at it. Yes, yes.
There is another option. I don't mean to complicate this more than it already
right.
is. But insofar as specific rule amendments may be necessary for certain instances, for certain bills, in the passage of certain legislation for Parliament, one option may be that, because even if you agree to rules now, those rules may change subject to different decisions elsewhere. And also, of course, rules take some time to essentially go back to the Rules Committee. It might be referred back here. So one option being, if there is a risk, as Ms. Ambrosini was saying, that certain things may be challenged, then you could adopt interim rules. That's one possibility. Or House resolutions that just set in place certain mechanisms, certain processes, subject to rules being finally agreed upon at some point.
But that's how we would normally work anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that we accept that rules may be of a temporary nature. But in the meantime, I think we should be mindful of our own mandate and our own responsibility to assist the Rules Committee if they're necessary. So I'm leaning more in favor of Mr. Ambrosini's. In fact, that is a proposal I mentioned. That go back, look at where the Act requires rules, where you think the Act is not explicit as to what the rules should be about, but you feel that we could use that as an opportunity to create the useful rules to assist so-called blank checks, filling the blank checks. Explore that. Nothing from out of this world, Let's start easy. Not further complicate an already complicated situation. Then let's, as soon as you're ready with something, let's reconvene specifically to look at those draft rules. And then table before the Rules Committee, and it's up to them to then say, well, look, we can't go ahead with the rules because NCD, let it be their problem, not ours. We should discharge our own mandate, and that's our point. With that, basically, yes, Mr.
No, I'm in agreement with you.
Yeah.
Could the madman referred to by Mr. Ambrosini have challenged the budget because the provision in the Constitution had not been met?
Not in the Constitution, definitely not. Okay. But in the Act itself.
The Constitution says Parliament must pass legislation allowing Parliament to amend many rules.
Does it say must or may?
May.
May. So you're not bound to pass the legislation. But now that you've passed it, then you have a problem with the legislation.
The madman has got, we've empowered him.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was dormant until now. Now he's provoked.
Dormant madman.
All right. Look, this is the last item, which is Mr. Ambrosini's request. Now, I'd like to suggest that if this issue is more of a political policy issue as opposed to technical amendment to the rules, the practice, like I said earlier, is this stuff that came to us was stuff that has been resolved at a policy level, where the different parties are in agreement, or in fact the rules have adopted policy and asked us to draft the rules to give effect to the policy. Now here we're being used as a platform to resolve the policy. Now the way in which we're constituted is such that we're not a representative of all the parties in Parliament, for example, unlike the Chief Whip. Now, what I would want to suggest is that maybe we should request that parties then reflect on this. Can we make such a request directly without reference to the rules? Or even referring to the Chief Whip's forum? And ask the Chief Whip's forum to advise the subcommittee on that issue. I think the DA representative said, as far as their proposed amendments are concerned, we're happy to have them go to the pool that's going to do the overhaul of the rules. I assume that that position will be maintained when he reports back to his committee, to his party. Yes, Ms. Anderson.
Okay, just a point of fact. My letter, there are two aspects. One about the resolution of the rules, and I think that's not before us. The other one is the purely technical aspect, in which I'm right or I'm wrong. My contention is that I have a constitutional right, as all of you do, to introduce legislation.
That's the one I'm referring to.
Yeah.
I'm saying.
Yeah, and the rules are taken it away. So there is a legal issue. If I'm right that the rules are unconstitutional, and this might suggest that we can ever. This forum is better suited for a technical discussion, action. If I'm right, then the rules must be changed. If I'm wrong, then it becomes an issue whether or not, as a political matter, the rules ought to be changed.
What this committee can do, in fact, is to request a legal opinion on a legal question that's been raised. Now, if that's your proposal, that you believe that the issue is not purely political, but that it's actually a constitutional question, that means a constitutional answer, if you like, then we can commission such an opinion, and then we can discuss as a subcommittee your point of view vis-à-vis Parliament's opinion. Unless, of course, we feel that we can dispose of the matter without necessarily. So that it's not a party political position that's been put forward as a policy question in terms of the development of the policy of Parliament, but it's actually a technical, legal, or constitutional question that you raise, which, of course, the committee can take advantage of.
I'd say, well, this is a legal issue.
Yeah, well, we can come to that.
So, but I table that's a bigger issue, and I think this committee and the rule committee need to put its mind around the issue of whether or not legally I'm right. Because this is a threshold issue. If I'm right, then there is an obligatory act.
Obviously, the rules have to comply with the Constitution, and if they get to relate to the constitutionality of the rule, and we'll be answering that issue before. Such as the leader of the opposition issue, that was one phrase.
That one was wrong.
It hasn't been defined. Can we just make sure that stuff that's still needs to be referred to us? Gentle, put it on the agenda.
Well, that's covered for you. That's too much to be discussed. Yeah, we've given our opinion. They need to come back to us.
That's the other thing about processes here. Yeah. The party, the group committee, the your subcommittee, and of course, keep this forum in between. But all right, if that's how you're putting it, let's deal with it as such. At our next meeting, we would then be favored with an opinion from Parliament, and then we can discuss your, and obviously it will be circulated to you beforehand so that you can study it vis-a-vis what you're pushing across, and then it will be presented to the conference, and then the committee would then take a decision and then advise the whole committee within that switch. Excellent. Now, that's where we conclude the agenda. We will revert back to you in terms of the scheduling of the next meeting. We will try to consult this team. We know it's very difficult to get attendance, and ideally we should appoint the date and put them on the table. But yeah, we'll leave matters at that for now. Thank you very much for coming, and enjoy the lunch.
I think I just want to bring to your attention with the matter of the consultant. Before you came, there was some agreement in the committee that we're going to, for the review of the rules, we're going to get a technical consultant in to assist in the rule review. Mr. Handik, who used to be the secretary to the government, he's the baby, his father, secretary to the National Assembly. And that we will ask Speaker to approve that he gets appointed. And the parties are all happy with that. This is a draft of a document that we need to present to Speaker, asking for permission to do that.
All right, let me just quickly deal with it. We, in your absence, took a decision. There is an outstanding matter, broader matter, of the complete review of the rules. And the committee for the opinion that it would be so involving that it would be ideal to propose the appointment of a consultant of that committee in that regard. That the staff appointed to assist the committee with actual drafting of the amendment would not be suited to carry out such a major project in the island. Now, the idea amongst other things is that they would go through the entire review, find who look at best practices elsewhere in terms of stuff that we already have in the rules, but there could be other things that we not that are not provided for in our rules currently, but which might be important from other to make our parliament a much more